Plantations in the Belgian Congo whose souls blaze more brilliant than Leopold's, and even tonight as new graves grow cold and chlorofluorocarbons warm up the globe, they live like that deep-ass John Carpenter flick. I mean, can we agree that the Orisha still permeates Santeria? Can we agree that Bordone has made itself at home in the Catholic Church? And if so, then when you see me amongst the leaves, don't think that I'm praying to the trees. I am praying through the trees, just like this poetry is now playing through me. I am a vessel, but unlike the good ship Jesus, I float in a direction in which the actual Son of Man teaches. See, death is like a prison full of souls that had to surrender. But the inmates can do things for you on the outside if you help to propagate their agenda. And tree roots, constellations, rivers, and streams, these are the evidence of things not seen. Think the Haitian Revolution was just Toussaint and Dessalines. No, no, that was the evidence of things not seen. They say superstition is the name that the ignorant give to their ignorance. And there must be a lot of superstition going around because cash has a spiritual significance with pyramids and acacia trees and signs and symbols of deities taken from our Kibbalah libraries and now permanently stored in the Vatican. And who am I? I be your operator, patching you into the infinite. If sex was death, we would be infinite, yet never reaching a climax, counting millenniums like days, intertwining my destiny with the stars like runaway slaves. You can trace my existence through drawings on caves, yet we submit to the same God. My job's to make you conscious of your subconscious, bring you to a new transdance every time your mind gets aligned with parallel galaxies that the Pharisees could barely see. Prepare to be taken to your ultimate destiny where your test will be to call me.
Now, go find the others. .com.
You know, I don't want to sound like a queer or nothing, but I'm really going to miss you guys when the show's over.
Hey everybody, this is Sam Bush, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Hi, this is Bill Hammond. I'm a dobro player, and I also play drums. If you love Winfield, love to jam, or if you just love to hear live acoustic music, I encourage you to come to KKFI's Winfield Warm-Up on Sunday, August 18th from 2 p.m. until 10 p.m. at the IBEW Local Hall 124. There will be over a dozen acoustic bands, plus multiple Winfield-type jams and a community sing-along. Directions and tickets at kkfi.org.
Long distance information. This is what great nations did. It would not be unfair to talk about the United States as having an inferiority complex during this time period and desiring that the rest of the world recognize what Americans already recognized, that America was a great nation. Guys like Teddy Roosevelt were obsessed with this. Now, Teddy Roosevelt is one of the most interesting American figures in all U.S. history. He is also just about every little American boy's favorite president. He was certainly mine. And it took me a lot of years to try to figure out why. And I think most American boys grow out of that fascination with Roosevelt, because the reason we are so fascinated as little boys with Teddy Roosevelt is because the things that motivated Teddy Roosevelt, the things that were important to Teddy Roosevelt, are the very same things that motivate little boys. He was an adventure junkie, as one associate pointed out about Teddy Roosevelt after he became president. They said, quote, "You must always remember that the president is about six," end quote. Which wasn't that untrue. The guy sort of reminds me sometimes of a heavily armed, imperialistic, racist version of Peter Pan. You know, always leading a troop of kids on an adventure. Now, the whole racist thing requires a little explanation, too, because racism is something you really have to grade on a curve. If you took Teddy Roosevelt out of his time period and brought him into today and sat him down, he would make Archie Bunker look like a liberal. He would be a screaming racist. But if you grade him on a curve and consider the average American's level of racism in the late 19th century as the benchmark, then Teddy Roosevelt is a progressive on the issue of race. But when he talks about race, he's not talking about it in a KKK, a Ku Klux Klan sort of way. Race in the late 19th century referred to not just ethnicity, as we would use it today, but also culture and a number of other factors that played into their idea of social Darwinism that we mentioned earlier. Why is this race higher or lower on the cultural scale and survival of the fittest and all that kind of stuff that they thought about at the time? To those people, the idea of national greatness was connected to warfare. Fighting in and of itself was valuable simply because of the side benefits it conveyed. It conveyed benefits to a country, and it conveyed benefits to the individuals who fought in conflicts. The 1890s, many historians have written, was a period sort of psychological crisis for many of the leading nations of the world, who believed that their populations were becoming soft and flabby, that civilization was weakening the martial virtues of, you know, Western man. And for a guy like Theodore Roosevelt, war was the equivalent of going to the gym. He considered himself to be an Anglo-Saxon, and he considered one of the major virtues of the Anglo-Saxon race to be military superiority. There was a whole military history connected to Aryanism and the Indo-Europeans from a million years ago, practically, where they had taken over the world due to their great martial virtue, and there were these historians who would track how the Indo-Europeans had settled in certain countries, and lo and behold, now those countries led the world. And I mean, it was this whole, you know, if the social Darwinism was a pseudoscience, this whole Indo-European warriors, you know, leading the world, you know, throughout history was a pseudo-history. And Roosevelt bought into it lock, stock, and barrel. He romanticized war in a way that is almost comical to modern eyes. Comical and dangerous. He wrote a book with his intellectual compatriot Henry Cabot Lodge called Hero Tales, which is almost silly by modern standards, by the, you know, nationalistic heroism it conveys. You know, the soldier that gets shot between the eyes and who still refuses to let the flag touch the muddy ground. I mean, it's just, it's so overdramatic and vainglorious, and yet it's the kind of thing that people lapped up in this time period. This is perhaps the most patriotic period in American history, and sometimes it just boggles the more cynical modern mind to see it. And yet you have to understand that if that's what public opinion is like, these are the kind of pressures that a president like William McKinley has to deal with. When General William Tecumseh Sherman, who we mentioned earlier, the Civil War general, he had a famous quote about the romanticism of war and how it was all moonshine, he said. When he uttered those lines, he was talking about people like Theodore Roosevelt, whose ideas about the glory and romance of warfare goes back to, you know, history before Homer's The Iliad. He belonged, by the way, to things like the Boone and Crockett Club, Roosevelt did. The Boone and Crockett Club was a group of Eastern rich hoity-toity guys who wanted to play Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett. Roosevelt was a New York-born rich kid who wore spectacles and was asthmatic and went and got himself a job on a Western dude ranch so he could play cowboy. He wanted nothing more himself than to fight in a war. He wanted to kill somebody in combat. See, this is funny because, in a sense, he's a little like Winston Churchill during this time period, too. Churchill wanted to get into combat and measure his mettle and bravery and all this kind of stuff, which was not an unusual thing for this time period. It's part of the era. But if you had a child today that said that when they grow up they really want to kill a few people just to see what it feels like and to test themselves, you'd send him to a psychiatrist, wouldn't you? In this time period, that was a pretty average thing for an American boy, you know, who was playing soldiers and cowboys and Indians and everything in the backyard to want. Today, most American boys grow out of that. Theodore Roosevelt didn't grow out of that. He became part of a leading edge of politicians and an intellectual movement in America that helped chart the course for the country in the late 19th, early 20th century with ideas just like that. General William Tecumseh Sherman's famous quote about war was this, quote, "I am sick and tired of war. Its glory is all moonshine. It is only those who've neither fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, for vengeance, for desolation. War is hell." End quote. Theodore Roosevelt could not think that statement more wrong. To him, war was rejuvenation. It was what great powers did. It was what kept the race sharp and honed and able to do their sacred duty in the world. This is a guy who, when he was running for vice president later on in his history, would speak to a national organization of mothers. And to this national organization of mothers, he would tell these mothers that their job as patriots for the country were to breed and have male children who would then die for the cause of the country. You know, in other words, they're breeding material for people whose job it is to grow up, fight in the military, and die for, you know, the greatness and honor of the nation and the renown of the country. And these women, to show you the tenor of the time, stood up and gave him a standing ovation. Roosevelt has hardly been on the job very long at all when he speaks to the Naval War College and talks to these sailors about his views on race and national greatness and the job of the Navy. In this speech, he mentions war 62 times. To give you a little feeling for Roosevelt's, you know, conversational topics, here's a little snippet from that speech. He told the cadets and sailors at the Naval War College, quote, "All the great and masterful races have been fighting races, and the minute that a race loses the hard-fighting virtues, then it has lost its proud right to stand as the equal of the best. No triumph of peace is quite so great as the supreme triumphs of war. It may be that at some time in the dim future of the race, the need for war will vanish, but that time is yet ages distant. Diplomacy," he said, "is utterly useless when there's no force behind it. The diplomat is the servant, not the master of the soldier. There are higher things in this life than the soft and easy enjoyment of material comfort. It is through strife, or the readiness for strife, that a nation must win greatness. We ask for a great navy, partly because we feel that no national life is worth having if the nation is not willing, when the need shall arise, to stake everything on the supreme arbitrament of war, and to pour out its blood, its treasure, and its tears like water, rather than submit to the loss of honor and renown." End quote. He famously said that he thought the country needed a war because so many of these peaceniks at his old alma mater of Harvard were teaching people about the flab-inducing benefits of peace. Roosevelt, Henry Cabot Lodge, and people like Albert Beveridge are considered to be part of a interesting crowd in American history of imperialists. Now, Roosevelt hated that term. He preferred expansionism, or another word he used, Americanism. But what this really is a very short-lived period in American history where extreme nationalism held sway. And it was so open is what makes it unusual. There are people and historians who will argue that this has always been America's policy, or that it's been America's policy since this time period. But Americans, if that's true, have never been comfortable with being very open about it. During this period, for a very short period of time, there was a very large group of Americans who openly advocated the taking of other countries and regions, and they did so couched in the idea that this was good for everyone. If America is like a schizophrenic giant, the way you fuse the two halves of the character, the one that wants things and the one that considers itself almost unrealistically good, is to combine those two things. You can have conquests, and that by having those conquests, you will be doing something that is almost unrealistically good, even for the people you conquer. Listen to the way historian and politician Albert Beveridge describes the mission of the Anglo-Saxon race, the God-given mission of the Anglo-Saxon race, to both conquer, rule, and help the rest of the world. And understand that when Beveridge says this, he's really mimicking a lot of what the rest of Europe is saying about the validation and reasons for conquering places like Africa and colonizing. He's just couching it in an American mythology. And while it sounds very un-American in terms of America's past, where founding fathers like John Quincy Adams famously said that the United States does not go abroad in search of foreign monsters to slay, when confronted with that kind of evidence by another group of Americans known as the anti-imperialists, which included such famous luminaries as Mark Twain, the retort from people like Theodore Roosevelt was that that sort of philosophy might have been fine in the age of sail, but that they now lived in the age of steam, and the realities were different, and it called for an updating and upgrading of America's civilizing mission. Beveridge told Congress that America had an obligation to the world, and that the question of this obligation was deeper than any question of party politics or any question of mere foreign policy. He said to the Senate, quote, "It is elemental. It is racial. God has not been preparing the English-speaking and Teutonic peoples for 1,000 years for nothing but vain and idle self-contemplation and self-admiration. By no means." He said, quote, "He has made us the master organizers of the world to establish system where chaos reigns. He's given us the spirit of progress to overwhelm the forces of reaction throughout the earth. He's made us adepts at government, that we may administer government among savage and senile peoples. Americans must recognize," he said, "how fully the human race depended on them and on Providence acting through them. Quote, were it not for a force such as this, the world would relapse into barbarism and night," he said. "This is the divine mission of America, and it holds for us all the profit, all the glory, all the happiness possible to man. We are trustees of the world's progress, guardians of its righteous peace." End quote. That's a man right there who has managed to fuse the two schizophrenic half of the American character. And as it regards, for example, to a place like Cuba, this is a guy who could argue that we need to take over Cuba, and we need to do it for the good of us, the Cubans, the Spanish, the world, the race, and God. If you're William McKinley, that sort of raises the stakes over the issue of whether or not the U.S. should or shouldn't intervene in a place like Cuba, doesn't it? And it's not just Cuba, by the way. This little slice of American history that this particular podcast deals with involves a time period in U.S. history where there's a massive amount of change in a very short period of time. To give you an idea of the slice we're talking about here, started, if you will, in 1890, the year the frontier closes, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. In 1890, there are no overseas U.S. colonies. The U.S. is principally a North American, entity. And in 1890, that same year, we fight one of the last armed encounters with Native Americans in our history at a place called Wounded Knee. Not really a battle, more of a massacre, but to show you how modern it is, there are Hotchkiss guns used. They're not quite machine guns, but modern cannon in the modern sense of the word. The natives are absolutely massacred. It is a horrible situation, but it shows you, sort of the time period we're still talking about here. 1890, we're fighting Native Americans, and the United States has no overseas colonies. A mere 10 years later, The United States has a bunch of overseas colonies, and Cuba may not be the number one, you know, place on the list. The other place that's getting a lot of discussion during this, you know, period from 1890 to 1900 is Hawaii, which has its royal government overthrown in a coup attempt in 1893, led by mostly Americans involved in business interests, sugar interests, pineapple interests, and some missionaries. They overthrow the queen in Hawaii, try to get the U.S. to annex them. The Congress is all for it, but President Cleveland doesn't go for this, and guys like Lodge and Roosevelt consider this borderline treason that he won't annex Hawaii. There are all sorts of national security arguments, by the way, at the time. The idea that Hawaii is like the Pacific Gibraltar, that if the Japanese get their hands on Hawaii, think about what that would mean for U.S. security. But there's other strains of American history that are fabulously interesting if you wanted to examine them. And part of it is the racist aspect. This whole racist aspect works, you know, in sort of a double-edged capacity. In one side, you know, you argue that people like these Hawaiians or these Cubans or any of these people, they can't govern themselves. They're hardly capable, you know, of not killing each other if there's no outside, you know, enlightened European government there. So we have to rule over them in sort of enlightened despotism while they grow into self-government, right? That Anglo-Saxon, you know, wonderfully organizing ability, God-given, you know, all that kind of stuff. But then you have this other problem where, oh my gosh, if you make Hawaii a U.S. territory and then eventually a U.S. state, you're going to have all these dark-skinned people that are Americans. You have the same problem in Cuba. All of a sudden, you know, you go, gosh, we can take them over and rule over them because they're this lower race. But oh my gosh, we don't want to have this lower race introduced into the United States. So this whole racism thing is kind of a come here, come here, come here, go away, go away, go away kind of sort of an aspect. And so Cleveland denies the idea of Hawaii being annexed in 1893, but quickly U.S. attention goes right back to Hawaii right during this same period. Okay, and in 1898, which is the crucial year, Hawaii will figure just as prominently in U.S. history as Cuba will, along with some other territories. There's a famous incident where Henry Cabot Lodge, to show you the mood at the time, brings a map into the Senate chambers, and he's got all these little red Maltese crosses with him. And the map shows the world, and Lodge sits there and starts putting crosses in all the spots he thinks the U.S. should take over. He puts a cross in Cuba, cross in Puerto Rico, cross in Panama where they want to build a canal, cross in Hawaii, and the Senate starts applauding. Lodge said it was the most popular speech he ever made in the Senate. It shows you this mood in America, which is really unlike, you know, the mood before or after. This brief little period in history where it looked like great nations conquer people. The United States was really sort of feeling like, hey, we're a great nation and no one notices. How do you get it to notice? You act like the other great nations. What do? They get out their little red Maltese crosses and they start taking places over. Now, this is the part of the story, it's worth pointing out, where all the different histories start to diverge if they haven't already. A very mirror-like tale here where people see what they want to see. No one can quite explain why what happens happens without being kind of, you know, in their own historical bias about it. I like what Luis Perez Jr., the historian that uses a lot of sources from the Cuban archives and the Spanish archives, what he has to say. Basically, in his mind, what happens is the U.S. kind of miscalculates on this whole idea of autonomy. You remember, autonomy, as the Cleveland administration saw it, was a wonderful way to sort of not allow the Cuban insurgents to take over Cuba, to give Cuba time to either crush the rebellion or to come to some sort of terms where the atrocities that were making such news go away, but the U.S., with their longstanding no-transfer policy, doesn't have to worry about any other countries coming in and taking Cuba, you know, right off the U.S. coast. And by the way, the danger was seen as being either from the British, who were in a very weird time with American relations here. There was almost a controversy over Venezuela during this period with the British, but also the Germans, who were a recent nation. You know, they officially declared nationhood in 1870, 1871, after the Franco-Prussian War, and now they were building a navy, and that navy was looking for bases overseas. There was a naval thinker named Alfred Thayer Mahan, who became hugely important during this period, in large measure because of Roosevelt and Lodge, who loved the guy, who wrote this book about how all the great powers of the world were naval powers, and that if you wanted to be a great power, you had to have a great navy, right? Well, to have a great navy in this time period, you had to be able to go around the world with your navy, wherever it needed to project power, we would say today. And all these ships ran on coal. So the only way you could do this was to have these coaling stations intermediately placed all over the world. So, you know, once you were starting to run out of coal, there was a U.S. base or a German base or a British base, well, there already were British bases, somewhere where you could refuel. So a lot of these territories that were on the, you know, Red Maltese Cross list of people like Lodge were places that could create coaling stations so that U.S. naval power could continue to project power like all great nations do, wherever it was needed. This is partly why Roosevelt being the Undersecretary of the Navy is huge when he's reading naval strategists like Alfred Thayer Mahan, who tell him all great nations have to have great navies. Now, the situation in Spain becomes dangerous for McKinley during 1897. This according to Perez. Like I said, the different historians have different theories. But Perez's attitude is that in 1897, the Cubans begin to win the war. Spain is tapped out financially. They're busy. They're crushing a rebellion in the Philippines, but it's emptying their treasury. And the Spanish, who have sent almost 200,000 men to this little island of Cuba, have a ton of those people dying from disease. And this is a part of the story we haven't dealt with very much yet. But, you know, when we talked about the Eastern Front in the Second World War, we talked about the Russian, longstanding Russian idea of what they called General Winter, that the elements, especially the harsh winters in the Soviet Union or Russia in the earlier period, helped aid the defense against outside aggressors. So you had the weather working in the favor of a place like Russia militarily. In places like Cuba and other tropical areas, you had like general disease instead, or general fever instead of general winter, where the tropical climate created all sorts of diseases that affected everybody, certainly, but affected people who were not used to that climate even more. In Cuba, you had, you know, typhus, malaria was another big one, but the real nasty, scary disease that they had in Cuba was something called yellow fever. Yellow fever is one of the hemorrhagic fevers, like Ebola in Africa. Writer Evan Thomas has a description of what it was like to suffer from yellow fever. And listen to this description and then understand why, if for no other reason, the U.S. would be worried about the situation in Cuba if outbreaks of yellow fever became an issue, especially when you realize how many people are going back and forth between Cuba and places like Florida. Thomas said of yellow fever, quote, "Disease accounted for most Spanish casualties. Death from yellow fever, also called the black vomit, also called yellowjack, the most common of these devastating ailments, was particularly horrible. The mosquito-borne infection essentially melted soft tissues so that sufferers bled from the nose and gums, rectums and genitals, and vomited up something that looked roughly like coffee grounds, but was actually stomach lining and intestine. Howling and ranting as they bled from every orifice, patients had to be tied down in bed so they would not splatter the infection around the wards." End quote. Any disease that makes malaria look good by comparison is pretty darn nasty, and this general disease, comparing it to Russia's general winter, was at least as effective as Russia's weather barrier, because the Spanish at this time period, after years of trying to put down the Cuban insurrection, had suffered a couple thousand casualties due to Cuban insurgents and some 50,000 casualties plus due to disease. The U.S. had to consider both, you know, how a disease outbreak in Cuba might affect the southeastern, you know, portion of the United States, which was also subject at times to yellow fever, but also had to factor that into a cost of any intervention. Whether or not you feared Spain was one thing, but when you put troops in Cuba, what happens if they start coming down with yellow fever? That's a big concern. But you have to weigh those disease concerns next to the other concerns that were coming out of Cuba. Right around this time period in 1897, another report is made to McKinley that perhaps as many as 400,000 Cubans who had been moved to reconcentration camps had died, and that the numbers might be leveling off, but the only reason they might be leveling off is because there weren't as many people to die anymore. In addition to that, there was another angle. Once again, it depends on which history you read, you know, concerning what gets emphasized. But the angle here that's also potentially very interesting, and that also potentially reminds one of modern times, has to do with politics. Both the Democrats and Republicans during this time period were wary of not being patriotic enough, not being anti-Spanish enough, not being pro-Cuban enough, and not being pro-humanitarian enough. In addition, the country's mood was uber-patriotic, jingoistic, if you will, and it brings up an interesting question worth asking. In a representative country like the United States is, or was supposed to be, what should it do in order to respond to the will of the people if the will of the people during a specific time period is expansionistic or imperialistic? In a democracy, what if the people want to go abroad conquering other peoples? Is the proper move to do what they want and say the will of the people is to take over Cuba and our other neighbors and to grab colonies, so that's what we're going to do? Someday we'll do a podcast on the Peloponnesian War and the population in Athens who had closer to a true democracy, and that issue will come up again. But it's an interesting question to ask because politics plays a big role in this too. And it puts McKinley square in a very strange position. He seems to be trying to walk the middle of the road between the peace advocates and the jingoes, and he's got both in his administration and both in the American population. The way McKinley does this is similar to what Cleveland does. He tries to push this autonomy idea, because the autonomy idea seems to be a way to give the Cubans more of what America has, a representative country. You won't have as much stuff like taxation without representation, but at the same time, you won't have to risk Spain turning over Cuba to some third party. And this is especially important now, because as Luis Perez had suggested, the Cubans have started to win the war. What happens if the Cuban insurgents win now and take the island from Spain? Doesn't that violate the no-transfer clause? How are you going to portray yourself as defenders of Cuban liberty, Cuba Libre, if the Cubans take the island over, and then you feel forced to go take the island from them? Or to take the island from the Cubans to prevent someone like the Germans from coming in and having a new coaling station 93 miles off the U.S. coast? The situation for McKinley was fraught with danger, and you can see him trying to maneuver through these treacherous waters of this delicate Cuban question, and then things happen that just sort of take it out of his hands, and they happen one right on top of the other. The first thing that happens is a Spanish diplomat writes a very frank letter back to Spain criticizing McKinley. Basically saying he's a weak politician trying to, you know, work both sides of the fence. I'm paraphrasing here, but that's basically what it said. Sends the message via telegraph, and someone from the Cuban-American junta, you know, who's been pushing for American involvement or at least recognition of Cuban belligerency, gets a hold of the telegram and gives it to, like, the newspapers, you know, which are already so pro-Cuban, it's crazy, and makes public, you know, these nasty comments by the Spanish diplomat about the U.S. president. In this uber-patriotic mood, you can imagine the reaction Americans had, you know, about that, the effrontery. The diplomat resigns, but the situation remains tense. In addition to this, the entire situation, you know, amongst Spain's political class has changed. And it's changed because an anarchist bullet changed it. In 1897, in August, an anarchist assassinates the head of Spain's government, the guy who'd been talking about Cuban autonomy, but talking about it like a reward for good behavior. You put down your weapons and you can maybe have autonomy. We're going to try it in Puerto Rico. You know, look how it's going over there. Wouldn't you like to have that? We'll give up the rebellion and maybe you can. When the leader of Spain is killed by that assassin, a more liberal government takes hold in Spain, and they decide to try the autonomy idea out first. You don't have to put down your weapons. We'll do autonomy, and that will be a way to defuse the revolution, right? Or so it was thought. The problem is that it had almost the exact opposite effect. In the same way that when President Cleveland brought the idea up, the Cuban insurgents looked upon this as good news. Máximo Gómez and all these insurgents in Cuba thought that this signaled, you know, Spanish weakness. Gomez came out and said, I've never before predicted an end to this war or a time limit, but it's going to be over within a year. You can see how weak Spain is if they're proposing autonomy now when they were swearing against doing something like that a while back. Now, the reaction of the Cuban insurgents might have been predictable. The reaction that caught everyone a little by surprise was the reaction of the Spanish loyalists in Cuba, who saw autonomy as a complete betrayal. And later history shows us why, right? I mean, just look at the reaction of the South Vietnamese when the U.S., you know, negotiates its treaty with the North. I mean, you have tons of cases like this later on where the people who've been loyal to the cause and fought the insurgency every step of the way feel completely undercut when concessions are given to the insurgents. In this case, many of those Spanish loyalists in Cuba had left their farms and their homes in the country, run into these fortified cities to avoid having their throats slit by the rebels for being pro-Spanish, and now the Spanish were talking about turning the local government over to those very people that they had left their farms because they were scared of. The entire situation explodes. Riots happen in Cuba. They're breaking into, you know, newspapers on the island that favor autonomy. And the government in the United States begins to worry about the safety of Americans on the island. American newspapers, especially the ones in New York, that have always been just, you know, on pins and needles, just waiting for the war. You know, Blair headlines that war is imminent, it's coming, you know, war with Cuba next. And Evan Thomas tells a wonderful story about Theodore Roosevelt, once again going back to this idea that he just can't wait for a war to happen. You know, I had a grandfather who was this kind of a guy, a real adventure junkie. And he was the wrong age, a little too young for the First World War and a little too old for the Second World War. And he was crushed by this, wanted to lie to get into the First World War early, wanted to lie to get into the Second World War, was just dying for the adventure. And so I can kind of, you know, I can see how Roosevelt was. But Evan Thomas tells this story about when it looked like war was imminent, Roosevelt goes to his boss's office, the Secretary of the Navy, to basically tell him if the war comes, I'm not going to be here in Washington working for you. And this tale shows how different Roosevelt, if he really was like a proto-neoconservative, how different he was from the modern version. Because most of the modern neoconservatives avoided going to war when they were of fighting age. And they'll often, you know, the critics of the modern neocons often call them chicken hawks because they'll send others to go to war when they themselves didn't go. Teddy Roosevelt is the opposite of a chicken hawk. He's a hawk. And here's the way Evan Thomas describes this conversation he has with his boss, the Secretary of the Navy, concerning this apparently imminent breakout of hostilities in Spain. Thomas writes, quote, on the morning of January 13th, Roosevelt walked into the office of Secretary of the Navy Long and shut the door. That night Long wrote in his diary, quote, he told me that in the case of war with Spain, he intends to abandon everything and go to the front. End quote. Thomas writes, in words later excised from his published journal, Long wrote, quote, the impetuosity and fierceness with which Roosevelt insists upon this are rather amusing. He's gone so far daft in the matter that he evidently regards it as a sacred duty, which he owes to his own character, to improve every opportunity of dying with malaria or being played out with a hospital fever in this bushwhacking fight in Cuba. I tried to persuade him that if it was his country which was at stake, or his home should be defended, such a course would be worthwhile. I called him a crank and ridiculed him to the best of my ability, but all in vain. The funny part of it is that he actually takes this thing seriously. End quote. He's not the only one that took the whole thing seriously. The diplomat in charge of American affairs in Cuba sends a secret message to a U.S. warship in Key West, Florida, telling it it needs to coal up and head to Havana Harbor right away, just in case this violence breaks out and threatens American lives. There's a ship in Key West that history calls a battleship. To be more specific, it was a second-class battleship. To be even more specific, it was really an armored cruiser called the USS Maine. which in January, sort of later January, sets course and steams to Havana Harbor and arrives there at the end of January 1898. Thomas tells another story of an argument at a hoity-toity party that Roosevelt is at, where he's arguing with McKinley's most powerful financial, we would call him today like a PAC member or corporate backer, a guy named Mark Hanna, and they're having an argument about the situation that seems to be brewing in Cuba. Apparently, Roosevelt starts yelling and says to Hanna, quote, "I hope to see the Spanish flag and the English flag gone from the map of North America before I'm 60, end quote. Hanna replies back to Roosevelt, "You're crazy, Roosevelt," and then says later at the party how thankful he is that the administration that he backed financially didn't give Roosevelt the Secretary of State job, or, quote, "we'd be fighting half the world." And then he said that sending the Maine to Havana was, quote, "waving a match in an oil well for fun," end quote. At first, it didn't seem like that. In late January, the Maine arrives in Havana and has the opposite effect that Hanna predicted. Everything seems to calm down. The Spaniards are enjoying the U.S. crew. It's so calming that Spain and the U.S. diplomats say, when the Maine goes back home, send another warship. It's having a good effect, and it's sort of keeping the Germans out, who've been sending more and more warships to Havana, scaring the U.S. government about their intentions. Everything's going swimmingly until the night of February 15th, 1898, a mere 6 days since U.S. newspapers had printed that diplomatic cable that had been seized secretly from the Spanish diplomat that was perceived as a terrible insult to President McKinley, that the newspapers, especially in New York, were still harping upon. By the next morning, the newspapers in New York will have a completely different story, taking up their entire front pages and more. On the evening of February 15th, sometime between 9 and 10 in the evening, a massive explosion rocks the city of Havana. Author David Traxel has put together several different eyewitness accounts. They start off with a couple of soldiers that are sitting watch on the deck of the Maine, who talk about what a clear, nice evening it is. They can hear the sounds of revelry in Havana from, you know, off the shoreline, and, you know, nothing particularly going on. And then all of a sudden, the front of the Maine starts shuddering, and very quickly after that, a massive explosion. It rocks the ship, with basically everything from about the center of the ship all the way to the front of it blowing up into the air and then raining down on the people who are running for cover as the ship very quickly begins to settle to the bottom of the Havana Harbor. American Sigmund Rothschild is on a ship, an American ship, also in the harbor where he can see the Maine, and he wrote that he had, quote, "heard a shot like a cannon shot. It made me look toward the Maine. I saw the bow rise a little. After a few seconds, there came a terrible mass of fire and explosion, a black mass. Then we heard a noise of falling material. It didn't take a minute until the bow went down. There was a cry, 'Help, Lord God, save us, help, help!' The cry did not last a minute or two." End quote. David Traxel then says, "a huge column of flame and gray smoke shot upwards to a height of 150 feet, and then spread out into a rolling canopy," which Rothschild said, quote, "which overhung the Maine and from which descended a rain of fragments of ship and of bodies, some pieces falling half a mile from the mooring," end quote. The famous American nurse Clara Barton had some time ago gone to Havana to provide medical aid to a city that apparently desperately needed it. She was working still at that late hour in Havana, and reported, quote, "the great glass door opening onto the veranda facing the sea blew open. Everything in the room was in motion or out of place." She says, quote, "the deafening roar was such a burst of thunder as perhaps one had never heard before. And off to the right, out over the bay, the air was filled with a blaze of light. And this in turn filled with black specks like huge specters flying in all directions. Then it faded away. The bells rang, the whistles blew, and the voices in the street were heard for a moment, and then all was quiet again," end quote. Traxel quotes Walter Scott Merriweather, who had just stepped through the door of a cafe, he said, when the blast hit, and reported, quote, "The city shook to a terrific explosion. Amid a shower of falling plaster, every light in the place went out, as did every other electric light in the city. People kept calling, 'What is it? What is it?' A man in the darkness yelled that the arsenal across the bay had blown up. But as a squadron of cavalry went by at a gallop," Meriwether, Traxel says, had been told by a tall Englishman, "that it must have been the Maine." Two American reporters stationed in the city to cover the conflict lied their way onto a boat being rowed out to the Maine. Remember, this is a dark harbor where all of a sudden searchlights have been turned on and are sweeping the bay, but there is some light being provided because the Maine is burning ferociously. And it's not just burning, but every few minutes a shell is set off by the heat. So, you know, you have whistling, rocketing, you know, cracking sounds, and it's a dangerous hulk, but there are people on there screaming for help. So this boat is rowing out there, and these reporters say that as the boat gets nearer and nearer to the ship with all of the artillery shooting off, that they start rowing less and less and try to not even go there, and the officer has to hit the sailors with a cane to get them to row out to the boat. The reporters are on that little boat rowing out, and they report that as they get nearer, they can begin to see what's going on by the light of the burning ship. And they said, quote, "The scene as it unfolded itself to our vision was terrible in its significance. Great masses of twisted and bent iron plates and beams were thrown up in confusion amidships. The bow had disappeared. The foremast and smokestacks had fallen, and to add to the horror and danger, the mass of wreckage amidships was on fire, and at frequent intervals, a loud report followed by a whistling sound of fragments flying through the air marked the explosion of a 6-pound shell." Traxel says the scene was lit only by the red glare of flames dancing on the black water until a beam of a searchlight swept across their part of the harbor, revealing that they were surrounded by dismembered bodies. Quote, "Great God, they're all gone. This is the work of a torpedo and marks the beginning of the end," said one of the reporters who had been sent to Cuba to report on the end if and when it came. This sure looked like the event that was going to touch off the war that some people had feared was coming for a long time, and others had been hoping to encounter a crisis that would be too good to waste so that they could have the wars that they so eagerly wanted. That included people like Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt. It did not include, apparently, President McKinley, who again, as I said before, the histories at this point begin to diverge wildly and they change over the eras. McKinley's been portrayed many different ways, but it seems pretty likely that he was a peaceful kind of guy, because if he had actually wanted war with Spain, the explosion of the Maine provided him all of the necessary justification for just that. Instead, he told a friend, quote, "I don't propose to be swept off my feet by the catastrophe. My duty is plain. We must learn the truth and endeavor, if possible, to fix the responsibility. The country can afford to withhold its judgment and not strike an avenging blow until the truth is known. The administration will go on preparing for war, but still hoping to avert it." End quote. Now, the reason that McKinley keeps talking about learning the truth of the explosion is because no one knows what the truth of the explosion is. You have to think about this like a 9/11 attack or a Pearl Harbor in terms of how much the nation was shocked by the revelation that almost 270 U.S. sailors had been killed. The explosion had occurred right under the crew's quarters, and they were all asleep. So the loss of life was heavy, and people, you know, didn't know what to make of this. I mean, imagine Pearl Harbor happening, but the United States being unsure about whether the perpetrator was Japan or some other country, or the 9/11 attacks happening, but there being a decent chance that maybe they were accidental. That puts you sort of where the situation is with the explosion of the Maine. The Secretary of the Navy, Theodore Roosevelt's boss, wrote that your opinion of what caused the explosion of the Maine is going to be based on your biases. Quote, "There's an intense difference of opinion as to the cause of the blowing up of the Maine. In this, as in everything else, the opinion of the individual is determined by his original bias. If he is a conservative, he's sure that it was an accident. If he's a jingo, he's equally sure it was by design." End quote. Within 48 hours, though, the New York papers have already made their decision, and they make it sound like it's not a question that's in doubt. William Randolph Hearst's New York Journal had the headline 48 hours after the Maine exploded, quote, "Destruction of the warship Maine was the work of an enemy," end quote. It had a giant picture on the front of a drawing showing the battleship with a submerged mine underneath the hull of the ship, and the words, quote, "The Spaniards, it is believed, arranged to have the Maine anchored over one of the harbor mines. Wires connected to the mine with a powder magazine, and it is thought the explosion was caused by sending an electric current through the wire," end quote. Hearst had no evidence at all to back that up. But this was an era where you didn't need evidence to back that kind of stuff up, and Hearst and Pulitzer's rival paper competed to see who could outdo the other in terms of wild stories about what the truth was without any relationship to the truth at all, because no one knew why the Maine exploded. Theodore Roosevelt told friends, though, he was sure that the dastardly Spanish had done it, which just confirms his boss's opinion that it depends upon your own biases what you thought actually happened. There's actually an interesting undercurrent in the whole why Roosevelt might have had the opinion he had thinking among historians, and it has to do with a well-known problem that these battleships had. Now, Roosevelt was a huge fan of these battleships. He loved them. He wrote about them when he went out on them. He was in large part responsible for the U.S. building them, but they were new technology. They'd never been involved in a major war, and there was a feeling amongst some people in Congress that they were floating death traps, that the amount of firepower on board made them as much a danger to their own crews as they were to the enemy. One guy called them a floating volcano. There had been at least 13 recent incidents just in the U.S. fleet alone where the coal inside the coal bunkers spontaneously combusted and caught on fire. Well, the coal bunkers were right next to the ammunition magazines, and there was a good amount of speculation by experts that what had happened on the Maine involved a spontaneous combustion of the ship's coal setting off the powder magazine, which no one disputed had exploded. The question was, had it exploded due to the coal setting it off, or because a mine underneath the ship had created, an initial explosion, followed by a secondary explosion? The fact that William McKinley seemed to search for a way to avoid war, in my mind, seems to vindicate him, on this question of whether or not McKinley was after a war with Spain, because he appointed a commission of investigators to try to determine what caused the explosion, and while the commission was undergoing its investigative work, began talking to Spain about ways that they could defuse the entire crisis. If you want a war with Spain, why defuse the crisis? The problem McKinley had was that what it would have taken in terms of Spanish concessions to mollify the Americans was more than the Spanish government could possibly hope to give. They were in a very brittle situation in Spain. The government was holding on by a thin strand. They were broke. They were fighting rebellions in Spain and still putting down one in the Philippines. The army was very upset with the government. There was a real chance of revolution. And the amount of concessions the Americans needed to make the American people back off their war fever was a lot. There was a large gap between what Spain could hope to provide and what the Americans needed to make the entire thing work. Now, I can't tell you with any certainty what the mood of the country was during this 5-week investigative period, and that's because the histories disagree. And there are all sorts of interesting reasons proposed why they do. The early histories written right after these events suggest that the American public was absolutely overcome with war fever, that the demand for vengeance against Spain was so strong that American politicians completely lost the ability to have any, role in the decision-making at all, which, if true, means that McKinley was like a force of nature holding back the, the country's demand for vengeance against Spain. This was the narrative for a very long time, and as a matter of fact, still continues amongst a lot of historians, this idea that the American public now wanted war with Spain and felt that Spain had insulted the president and then blown up an American warship, probably. We asked the question a little earlier about, what is the role of a government who is supposed to be representing the people in a representative system. If the people want to attack Spain now because they feel like Spain deserves it and attack them first, what should the government officials do? These early histories make it sound like they simply had no choice. Historians who've written about the historiography of this era, people like Perez, who I've quoted at length, but Perez quotes all these other historians over the eras to show you how the narrative has changed. And he suggests...
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. An effort to reform federal mandatory sentencing laws has bipartisan support. A proposal by Illinois Senator Dick Durbin and Utah Senator Mike Lee would overhaul current drug sentences that reform advocates argue create racial disparity. Sentencing Project Federal Advocacy Council, Jeremy Hale, explains the legislation.